Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today posts under the name of It's Not a Fluke. Fluky Boy has worked for some time in surveillance and recently transferred to being an AP. I'm not going to call him that anymore. He's bigger than I am. Fluke, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
When did you get started working for casinos?
Well, I graduated high school up in Northern California and then immediately moved to San Diego. Went to junior college hoping to play baseball. Didn't work out so well, so ended up looking for a job. And I was lucky enough to have family in the casino business. And they immediately told me that, you know, come on up. We're going to get you a job as a dealer at Barona. And I'm like, dealer? I've never dealt or done anything in my entire life with gambling. Like, this is crazy. He's like, well, you're going to enjoy the money. It's going to be a good thing for you, good career. So I went up there and got into the school immediately, which was a nice little juice in. And that was as far as juice went. That was the most juice I ever got there, by the way. Because most people will think that, you know, because you have family, you get a little more extra things and stuff like that. And that was the only thing. So at 19, I started.
What's wrong with your dad? Can he get you better than that?
It wasn't my dad.
Did they have the personal interviews when you started there?
They did, but I did not.
Oh, you got lucky.
Yeah.
I had a nephew who went to the personal interview and he almost passed out. He was so nervous. You know, having to be interviewed by anybody.
Right.
But, yeah.
First job.
So you got lucky being able to avoid
that.
Yeah,
I got really lucky. The list to go into the school was fairly long of a waiting list. And I got in within 2 weeks of the beginning of the school. And people had been waiting for 6 months to get into the school. So it's a pretty prestigious school as far as the dealers go in the casino industry.
Is it a Barona-sponsored school or is it just
a
school in
the
era? It is
a Barona-sponsored school. And one of the main things that, you know, they do there is they make an incentive for you to do good at Barona. So part of the process of going through the school was you put up $400, I believe it was, and they say, okay, we will reimburse you if you pass the class and then work for us for 6 months. We'll reimburse you that initial $400 that you put up, which is, you know, an incentive to do well and to get your money back, basically. If anything, you know, and then continue your career as well. So,
and also, I don't know if at the time you were there, but you have to learn all the games. Well, they probably didn't have craps at that point, but
initially we learned all of blackjack, and then all of the carnival games.
Right.
Yeah. Not including baccarat, which is kind of like a carny game a little bit. But
right. Right. Yeah.
but then within the first 6 months that you were there, you were expected to learn baccarat. And then roulette and craps were optional, but they pushed you to do it if you were actually a decent dealer as far as like with your hands and your math skills and stuff, which I was fortunate enough to do. I did roulette. I didn't do craps until I actually went up to a different part of the country, but I should have taken advantage of it. But roulette was a great deal there because we had probably the closest to real roulette in the state of California compared to most other Native American casinos went, because most places use cards, and they had to use cards back then. So most Native Indian casinos will use cards on their roulette tables, as well as the craps at Barona. They use cards as well, but they tried to make it as real to real normal roulette as possible, and normal craps with the dice as possible, because that was a big psychological thing with players. They want to touch the dice. They want to see the ball moving around the wheel, you know. So and Barona did that very well. So it made me become, you know, really interested in how the innards of casinos worked. And throughout that process, with, you know, knowing and having the juice through my family, I got to meet higher ups, like people that were really involved in the process and policies and stuff with Barona.
Like
Max Rubin, correct. And there was another gentleman that I got to talk to as well. His name was Lee Skelly.
Probably still is.
Yeah. And Max, you know, he got to really have his hands on as far as like teaching dealers and teaching floor people and helping us understand how certain things can help protect and make things better for the casino. It's like coming out of the dealer school, we had to absolutely know basic strategy. You could not come out of the school without knowing basic strategy. And most people were like, oh, well, that's, you know, normal thing maybe, but most dealers don't know basic strategy. And if you do know basic strategy as a dealer, you know, you can give good answers to ploppies and you can say, you know, they'll ask, what can I do with this hand? And then most dealers throughout the country will be like, well, you can hit or stay, you know, or those are your options. But as a player, you would more want to have a good answer, like a confident answer about like basic strategy, like I should double down on this hand. Yeah, you should double down on this hand because that's the correct basic strategy. So they pushed that on us to help with customer service, but then it also added a layer of protection because if we came off the game, we were told to tell our floor supervisors if the player was playing funny basic strategy hand, like incorrect basic strategy, like doubling ace nine versus a six. Kind of weird that he's doing that for some reason, you know.
But clearly there were ploppies make all kinds of deviations from basic strategies.
Right.
So you had to recognize who a good player was and then only those players make the deviations?
Yeah, well, I mean, as a dealer, you wouldn't make any decisions, but you would just kind of inform your floor that, hey, he's playing a little weird.
Well, also, there are different types of deviations that some are worth mentioning and some aren't.
Correct.
Right? So, like, if a guy stands with 14 against a 10, that's probably not worth mentioning.
Correct.
But if a guy is hitting hard 17, that's probably worth mentioning, right?
Right, right.
All right, so you left Barona after a while, and you moved down the street. Well, it's a couple, several miles. Nothing in San Diego County is down the street. But you moved to the Sequan Casino as a surveillance operator. Anything interesting happened in Sequan?
Yeah, quite a few things happened there. When I first got there, they were doing the investigation on the Tran organization. And the Tran organization was this giant organization that was going through, I believe, the entire West Coast, up and down Cache Creek, up into Washington, Thunder Valley, all these new Native American casinos. And they were recruiting dealers to pull off crazy cheating scandals with casinos. It just so happened that I was there and the FBI had come in and informed us that Tran organization's coming in very soon to Sequan. So we need your help to investigate them and make sure we're getting camera angles and we're going to, you know, move in, basically. So we got to see, and this is all on American Greed, like on YouTube. You can find it on there. But it's not very in too much detail. And I actually got to see, you know, a lot of the detailed stuff that went on as far as like how in-depth the scandal was and how detailed they were with everything that was going on. They were
so can you describe briefly what the scam was that they were pulling off?
Yeah, this specific place, they did many things at other casinos too, but at this, at Sequan specifically, they were doing false shuffles on six deck shoes of blackjack. And the dealer would come in and there would be Confederates at the table betting, you know, minimum bets, $5 chips. And then there was also a Confederate behind the table with a hooded sweatshirt on. He would be smoking a cigarette. So the dealer would deal, and the Confederate behind the table would be smoking a cigarette, and there'd be a microphone in his sleeve. As the cards came out, he would relay that information over through his microphone into a van outside in the parking lot where another Confederate was tracking every single card. And then the dealer would, you know, the shoe would end. The dealer would put the cards in the discard tray, bring them out to shuffle, but then he would do a false shuffle. When he did the false shuffle, you know, the cards would stay in order, and then another Confederate at the table would cut the good slug, the track slug, into play, basically. And then that dealer would push off the table. So now the dealer that was in on it is completely away from this, the crime scene, basically, and a new unsuspecting dealer would come in and deal the cards out like just a normal day because they had no idea. And then all of a sudden, max bets would be just pounding the table, 5,000, 5,000, 5,000, the whole entire table, because they knew exactly every single card that was coming out. So they couldn't lose, you know.
And they would do this both at blackjack and at baccarat, right?
Specifically blackjack at Sequan, but they did do baccarat at other casinos. And the baccarat moves that I saw were actually different, and they were less sophisticated because the tracking was all done right in clear day, right on front on the table with baccarat score sheet cards.
Just writing it down.
Just writing it down, yeah. It was pretty unbelievable.
That is kind of crazy. I mean, as sophisticated as they were in terms of training the dealers how to do false shuffles, which the videos I've seen were really pretty good. I mean, they really – the false shuffles, unless you're right there looking at it, you're never going to see it.
Right.
And unless you have a camera specifically aimed –
yeah, so
at the right angle.
Because we were informed, we were really able to get good, solid angles. And like the only angle that that was really able to really see was from behind. And at an angle from like the left or the right of the dealer from behind. Because from the front, it looked extremely perfect. Like it was, you could not tell that it was a false shuffle at all.
But then to do something so rank as to write the cards down
on
the baccarat score sheet just... It's crazy how...
Leaving evidence behind you.
Yeah.
And yeah. There's a side story to that, too, because a few years before that, I was playing a lot of poker in my younger days, and we had quite a few home games, and I was dating another poker dealer at the time, and she actually knew Pai Gal John, and Pai Gal John was the head honcho of this Tran organization, or at least he was in charge of the training of the dealers. And so I went to a home game one night, and Pai Gal John was there. And the lady I was with ended up introducing me to him. And he's like, hey, come on over here to this table real quick and check this out. I want to show you something. It's pretty cool. So we all go over into the room, and we sit down at the table. And he pulls out a deck of cards, poker cards, and proceeds to do a regular poker shuffle and then deals out, you know, nine-headed hold'em game. Burns a card, puts out three flop cards, burns another card, puts a turn down, burns another card, puts the river down, all face down so we can't really see it. And then he goes, watch this. And he flips over the community cards and it's a straight flush. And then he goes, no, that's not the end. Reaches for the first hand in the one seat, flips it over. It's the bottom end of the straight flush. Goes to the nine seat, flips the other one over. It's the top end of the straight flush. And we're holy crap.
So the bottom end, the first three cards made a straight flush for the guy with the bottom two cards. So
It's like basically the first hand would have like 3-4 diamonds, and then the community cards would be 5-6-7-8-9-10.
But he'd get that straight flush early, so he's going all in quickly.
Well, yeah. He's in on it, so he know.
He basically could really, you know, manipulate the deck and push pots to people if he really wanted to. If, you know, people were, I'm guessing, because he did work in a casino at one point, he was probably pushing pots to people that were either Confederates or really taking care of him as far as tips went. You know, so he was basically putting a lot of money into his pocket with this mechanic ability.
Actually, when I interviewed Chip Reese, he told me a story about a dealer who Chip was in the game, and the dealer, he was sitting next to the dealer, and as the dealer was picking up the cards, he just picked up two of the cards. Maybe they were two red aces, I forget, but say they were two red aces, and he kind of showed them to Chip, and then he just shuffled them into the deck, and the next hand, Chip has the two red aces in his hand. And there are guys who can really, really control those things through shuffles and deal them wherever they want.
Yeah, it was hard to believe at first, but then I saw it, you know, in person, and I'm like, well, this is real. This is crazy. And he can, you know, move that into a you know, real casino setting and really take advantage of it.
I'm guessing the guy with the low end of the straight flush was not in on it because he's betting the farm. Because he's
well, I think you could do something a little more subtle if you were actually in a game.
Right. But okay, high stake shuffle trackers. Apparently, that lasts a long time down there.
Yeah, I'd say it was a while ago, so it's not really good in my memory. But I would say about 8 months. This young gentleman, Asian male, would come in. And he would ride the bus in every single day from town. I'm not sure exactly where he was coming from, but he would come in from on the bus with a backpack full of cash. And it was generally around $100,000. And he would proceed to play our shoe games at Squan. And we couldn't figure out if he was counting. Like, he was not counting. We ran him down numerous occasions. Multiple people ran him down. And we couldn't find out or figure out what he was doing.
Now, this was the days before cash transaction reports and all that, I assume?
It was.
So, riding the bus, you had no license plate. No. And did they ever try to ID him?
Never. Never tried to ID him. And they just let him play because we had confirmed that he was not a counter. And that's what they were most concerned about. The people I'd worked with were not too savvy when it came to breaking down other angles of, AP and all that stuff, other than just straight card counting or cheating,
That's pretty much true around the country. I mean,
yeah, to give you an example, the people, some of the experience that I worked with, I believe we had 9 people working with us. And out of those 9 people, I was the only person with any gaming experience. There was also, a young person that worked with me that was 18 years old and had never had a job before. So these are the people that are, watching.
But must have been tribal.
Correct. Yeah. So she had her juice in. But, then there was also, ex-security guards. The director was, an ex-police officer. There was no real strong gaming background there. So... so this Asian gentleman would come in, like I said, with $100,000, and he was shuffle tracking, and it literally took 8 months for them to figure it out. And I believe he was up about, not terribly too much, maybe $150,000 by the time they actually figured out that he was shuffle tracking.
How did they figure it out?
I think they may have consulted with somebody else. I don't know exactly what happened, but I'm pretty sure they did consult with someone else about it.
Huh.
Did you have bankers on the game at that point?
No bankers at it.
Okay, because at the Sequan, Rob Wrightson was on our show recently, and he indicated when he was banking down there, there was all kinds of theft sponsored by the casino. So that must have been before your time.
Yes, it was before my time, yeah.
So...
And this guy, I know numerous players that have been harassed at Sequan... stopped by tribal police, ID demanded, that kind of stuff. So I'm kind of amazed. Although on the other hand, I would say, especially before the days of the cash transaction reports, there was a ton of money laundering going on in those casinos. And so the casinos, a guy who shows up with $100,000 in cash, a lot of times, and he was an Asian guy, which buys you a lot as well. So, today, I don't think that Sequan would let that go by. Not that they would know what he was doing, just that they would harass whoever was,
Right.
If he only made $150,000, why on earth was he coming with $100,000 every day?
Your edge is maybe only 2%, 2.5% shuffle.
Yeah,
tracking,
it's just a little bit better than counting
big,
straight.
Big swings.
Yeah. And it's just more of a, like a cover for counting, basically. Because you're trying to, fool the casino into that you're not counting, but shuffle tracking does involve counting. So
yes. Okay. What about employee theft? Any of that go on down there?
Yeah, there was quite a bit. Not significant amounts though. Daily jobs of surveillance operators weren't always to, look for card counters or shuffle trackers or hole carders and things like that. We had so much other stuff going on, and really like the performance evaluations that were given to us were not based on, you know, how many card counters we caught throughout the day or throughout the month. Or
what percentage of your time was actually devoted to looking for advantage play?
Approximately 10% maybe of a day, or 5% of a day. It was very little time.
And you mentioned that at the time there were only two of you in the surveillance room.
Correct. We were understaffed, but that was the norm for the entire time that I was there. It was two people. At most, it was three, and generally those two. And you know, we have to go to the bathroom sometimes. We have to go eat our lunch. So there's a lot of times where it's just you're one person in there as well. And you know, we had I think it was 32 screens that we're watching, and then like another. It was like 40-some-odd tables. So we're not watching every single table.
Well, know? And you mentioned that there were things that you had to watch whenever they happened.
Correct. So, like, the biggest one that I remember was when Garda, the armored truck service, would come in. We had to follow them as soon as they arrived onto the reservation, or, you know, within camera view. So we would live feed, follow them all the way into the casino. They would stop and, you know, get out of the truck, and they would do a delivery of money. And then they would pick up money, and we had to watch every single step that they did. And that would take a good, you know, 20, 25, 30 minutes to finish that entire process. You know, and the same thing with when they did the drop from all the slot machines. We had to follow the money cart, the drop cart. You know, a lot of investigations as far as like, in the restaurant, if somebody, you know, forgot to pay their bill and they walked out, if was it an accident or were they doing it on purpose? We had to run tapes back on that. And then we also, on our performance evaluation, as far as like what our job actually entailed, was finding dealer errors and procedural, when they would break procedures as far as like clearing their hands when they would leave the table and things like that. That's what our, daily stuff was mostly, you know.
Was this going back and reviewing older footage, or was this like live?
Live.
So like, would a boss call you and say, hey, this dealer didn't clear their hands, or?
No, it was the exact opposite, where our bosses were pushing us to find stuff like that and then call down and inform their bosses that, hey, your dealers are not clearing their hands when they're leaving the table, or they're, you know, they paid a push or things like that. So, you know, we didn't have time to really sit there and watch, you know, somebody's bet move up and down and make sure that they're counting or not, you know.
So let's say that your 18-year-old compadre that had never had a job before gets a call from the boss and says, I think this guy is counting cards. Mm-hmm. What did she now do?
She would actually look at me and be like, hey, can you take care of this? Because I don't know what to do. And I mean, literally, because she had no clue what to do. But we would do a,
but let's say it wasn't you though. I mean, obviously you knew how to count cards,
right?
But what if it was one of the people who didn't? What would they do?
Well, so we would do everything manually. We'd run the tapes back, you know, and hopefully we would get them live though, because all the cameras are fixed. Well, not all of them, but majority of the cameras are fixed straight above the table. So, you know, we have to track not only the cards, but we have to track the bet sizes and the bet variations. So what you need to do is you need to get a live feed at a different angle from the side, because then you can see the chips moving up and down. Because from the top, you cannot see the chips moving up and down. You can kind of guess to see how much they might have grabbed and put out there, but you're still guessing and it's not good enough, you know. So it has to be live to really get a good, accurate count. If you go back, though, you'll just be relying on just the cards only. And everything, like I said, is done manually there. This may have since changed.
So they'd write down plus one, plus two.
Plus one, plus two, yeah.
And so now, let's say this happens, mm-hmm. right? And you look at the tape and you can't tell, because you can't tell how much the guy's betting. Would you just then blow it off, or would you take his picture? And
we would take all the investigative work that we had done as far as like the tracking of the cards, and then, you know, whatever bets that we did see, and we would just pass the information along to the table game's shift manager, and then he would make a decision, or he or she would make a decision, because we would never have the power to give them a, you know, a yes, he's okay to continue to play, or no, we need to back them off. Unless it was something very detrimental, like cheating or something like that. Then we, hey, this guy's doing this, get him out of here. You know. But as far as card counting, though, it's definitely up to the shift manager.
And did you ever, like, did they ever say, like, well, take this guy's picture so we can watch him the next time he comes in?
Yes, we would do that automatically. Whenever there was a call from the pit and there was a question of, like, card counting or something else, we would always take pictures right away.
And did you guys have did you guys subscribe to Griffin, or was there OSN at that time? Or
There was OSN at the time, but we used Biometrica.
And how did that work?
And it was not as sophisticated as most people think. It was basically just like a upgraded binder, you know, as far as like...
Yeah, but I mean the facial recognition software itself.
We did not have facial recognition.
So you had the Biometrica book, but not the
The subscription through the software on the computer, where you could type in somebody's name or their appearance or whatever, their habits, and you could search through a database of things and hopefully pop up a picture of somebody that's possibly in your casino. But to me, it was very unreliable. There's just so many people in there that like it was hard to match people up based on things that, you know, may not even be true, basically. You know, most card counters don't use their real names a lot. And, you know, so we have so many different names in there. Like, you know, they could be, it's not a fluke, and it could be some other name, but it could be the same person. So it's hard to tell with Biometrica exactly who's in there.
Well, and a lot of the pictures are not very good as
well. Very grainy. Yeah. I'm sure things have changed to where, you know, they're pretty good high definition these days. But back then, and this was in the, you know, the early 2000s. It still wasn't that great.
Okay, we actually have more Sequan stories, but there's a lot more things to talk about. So after Sequan, you moved up to Reno, no longer in a table operator, or no longer a surveillance operator. You became a pit boss of sorts.
Correct.
Anything happened in Reno?
Yeah, so I went to a nice casino up there, one of the bigger ones, and I decided to become a supervisor, floor supervisor up there, pit boss. And for one, there was no training. They just said, go buy a suit and get out there and start raiding people. And
how did you get this job? Just because you had been a dealer in a...
Yeah, I mean, I had good knowledge because I had actually taken, you know, my own time and learned how to count cards and learned how to be, you know, how to master my craft of dealing and all that stuff. And I had a lot of motivation to do good. And I wanted to, you know, move up inside the casino business and collect an easy paycheck, basically, because it's a lot easier than on the other side. But so my bosses thought that I had, you know, the ability to become a supervisor. So they allowed me to do that. Like I said, I basically trained myself, though. But there was, you know, with my training and all that stuff and my abilities, they would put me into the high limit quite often because I did know how to count cards and I could protect their games, you know, a little bit better than most people. So there was this player that would come in every single day, nearly, you know, 5-6 days a week, basically living in our hotel, playing single deck, double 10-11, 3-2, which is a pretty good game to play. And he would spread from $25 on one hand all the way up to 3 by 2,000, which is
crazy. I could beat that game.
Yeah, even Bob can play that game.
And I could beat that game.
And they were just letting him play.
And they were just letting him play for a good year and a half. And I recognized immediately, I mean, not like immediately, but, you know, within reason, I was like, this guy's counting cards. There's no doubt. I mean, he's playing with the count, but he was.
Boy,
also,
this shows you how much Reno has changed. When they used to get three hands by of 2,000 in action, I mean, nowadays there's just no action when I go up there.
Yeah, I mean, every once in a while you'll get it, but it's mostly the smaller stakes that are up there in Reno, and the casinos don't really want to take that action too much. It seems like they're almost afraid to take a big loss or something like that, but. my bosses just didn't believe that he was counting. They were saying that he was too drunk because he would come in and he would immediately take a shot and he'd make a big scene about it and, you know, yell at the cocktail waitress and yell at me at the pit boss and like, give me a drink. And I need to get drunk as quick as possible. Like all this stuff, this act that he was putting on. And then he would order one beer. It was a Budweiser. I remember it perfectly. And he would take a sip out of it. And then that beer would just sit there all night. He would never get another beer. Maybe, I mean, he might exchange it or something like that. Maybe once or twice throughout the entire 8 or 10 hour shift that he was doing.
Jesus.
And he would act belligerently drunk, you know, and people were falling for it. And he continued to win and win and win and win. And I think he was up anywhere from $300,000 or $400,000, somewhere around there. And they still couldn't figure out that he was counting. So what they did was they ended up consulting with Bill Zender, who was a very, you know, prestigious, you know, surveillance and casino guy that knows a lot. And I got my hands on that report. I can't say how I got that, but they came back with saying that he was in fact counting, but he was making too many mistakes and he was too drunk, drinking too much, drinking too heavily. And they can expect that the money could probably come back. So what they did was allowed him to continue to play, but they were trying to, you know, make sure that he wasn't doing anything other than counting. So they would do these like basically rain dances around. They would shift the dealers off the table and change the dealers. They would change the cards. They would take the shuffle machine off the table 1 week and then put it back on and make sure they would send it back to Shuffle Master and make sure everything was on the up and up. And it was pretty unbelievable. And I was getting a kick out of it. And even the player was seeing all this stuff going on and he was laughing about it because he knew that he wasn't doing anything other than counting.
Wow.
They took the cut card from him. They wouldn't allow him to cut. And he would make I think it was about a month later, they ended up giving him the cut card back because they said, oh, well, he's fine to cut it. And then he would make this big deal when they gave him the cut card and he would take his glasses off and act like he was doing some little tricky move. But he really wasn't.
It's just mind-boggling. Anyway, if that player is a listener to the show, give us a shout. Maybe come on and tell us, your side of that story because that's amazing.
Yeah, it was truly amazing. The biggest thing that I took from that actually, and it kind of helped me understand more about the game was that like even if you do make these small mistakes, if you're spreading so big like that, it's not going to cost you very much at all. And like the biggest one that I saw was he had A6, and this is again to remind the listeners that it was a double 10-11 only. If you play A6 versus A6, you know you always hit.
Sure.
And if you're, you know, allowed to double, you would double. But this is a double 10-11 game, so you always hit. But if you do stand in a very high plus count, and even not even that high of a plus count, if you just stand on your soft 17, it doesn't really cost you that much. And like I said, especially with a big spread, it's only going to cost you pennies.
You know? If you're doing it on your small bet.
Correct. Well, yeah. And you know, even on the bigger bet, it's not going to cost you too much. You know, and it gives you some added cover, especially if you're putting on this huge act and spreading from, you know, table min to table max on three hands. So that was one of the biggest things that got him more time, I believe. And
yeah, it also shows you how much the industry has changed because nowadays, just being ahead $200,000 or $300,000 is going to get you booted. Even if you're playing roulette. I mean, it doesn't matter what you're playing. If you win that much, they're just going to tell you they don't want your action anymore.
Right. And that's in the end, that's what happened. He ended up at peak, he was up about $650,000. And then he proceeded to give back about $200,000. And then they finally gave him the boot and revoked all his, you know, his comps and everything. And then it was like a trickle effect because then every other casino in town followed suit. They saw that, you know, one casino had backed him off, and then all the other places started backing him off as well.
All right, we're talking to It's Not a Fluke, and we'll be right back. We're going to have a few commercials. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In June, there's a half-price gas and goods promotion. Throughout the month, for every $8,334 you play, instead of getting $25 in cash or free play, you're entitled to a $50 gift card for either Chevron or Walmart. There's a limit of 10 cards per person for the month. Assuming you value these cards at face value, this means the slot club returns 0.6% for the entire month, up to your first $83,000 of coin in. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Super Draw 6-Card Poker. This is a 10 coins per line game where you're dealt 5 cards, and in addition to drawing cards to fill in the ones you discarded, you get one extra card per line. There are extra categories in the pay schedule like 6-card royal, ace through 9 suited, 6-card straight flush, 4 of a kind with a pair, 3 pair, 2 3 of a kinds, 6-card flush, and a 6-card straight. You'll have to develop your own software to analyze this game because commercial products don't have all of these pay schedule categories. All right, we're back talking to It's Not a Fluke. After you were in Reno, you went to Northern California and you opened up a casino. What happened there?
I went to Northern California and did a grand opening of a big casino down there, and it's pretty amazing. There was 68 baccarat tables.
Wow.
Which was pretty crazy, and they in the beginning, they actually wanted one floor supervisor per table, which was kind of
wow,
unbelievable. And we didn't have the staffing for that. And they actually brought in a lot of people from Vegas to help out with the grand opening. I worked there for about a year, and I had some, pretty good experience with, with Reno, and I was one of the only people that really had experience as far as being a supervisor, because they had dealers that were coming out of the school that they were put on there, and they would immediately put them into a supervisor position. So you basically had the blind leading the blind for the first, good 6 months that we were there. I mean, I don't know exactly if there
was. The gambling business is so strong, they make money in spite of themselves.
Right.
Bad as I'm sure they were, they made a ton of money. So.
Right. I mean, they had to do emergency drop pools off the tables because the boxes were so full of money. And same with the slot machines. There was just so much money coming through those first couple of weeks. It was just like you could put anybody out there and you're going to make money.
But APs could go in there and they can make money too.
Yeah. And I'm sure there was a lot of people there that did that. And I actually, I ended up catching a guy on PyGow, switching hands. He would bet big on one hand, like, $250 to $300 maybe on one hand. And then on the other hand, he would bet, $50, which was probably the minimum. To play two hands, and he would pick up the first set of cards, and he would determine if it was a good hand or not, and then he would put that hand onto the big bet, and then pick up the other cards and move them to the other side.
I could beat that game.
So I told the dealer, like, just keep dealing, and I'm gonna call surveillance and security and all that stuff. And as soon as security came, the guy recognized it and just started running for the door, and they started chasing after him, and I'm pretty sure they ended up getting him. And I'm sure he was not the only person doing that kind of stuff, but because there was, I'm sure there was a.
Well, the people who are really good at that, at cheating, are never caught.
Correct. Yeah.
I mean, I know guys who were cheats for decades that just never got, but it's the guys who are kind of
amateurish,
not very sophisticated at it that are the ones that get caught.
Yeah.
So you left there because they didn't like the way you handled a particular lady who was playing in the High Limit Room. What happened there?
Right. So I was out in the Baccarat pit watching the Baccarat tables, and I went to my break. On my break, the pencil, or you know, the scheduler for our department came into the break room and told me, you know, in the High Limit, there's something going on. They need your help back there. And my bosses knew that I had, you know, experience with, you know, catching card counters, and then I caught the guy on Pai Gow. So they probably felt like that I could go help do something, you know, fix whatever was going on. So I go back there, and the very first hand I see this lady betting 500. She flips over a blackjack and then proceeds to cap her bet with another 2,000 on top.
I could beat that game.
It's another game that you could beat for sure.
Nice work if you can get it. Yes.
So, you know, and she was claiming that she was drunk and all this stuff. And I immediately walked over and I you know, like, no, you can't do that. And I took the 2,000 and I handed it back to her and told the dealer, just pay her 750 for the blackjack and that's it. And then immediately I got on the phone and told my boss, hey, this lady's capping her bets. You need to do something about this, you know. Because as a supervisor, it's not my job to make a decision to kick somebody out or to tell somebody they can't play anymore. It's, you know, especially these days, it's the higher up that's going to make these calls. Whether it's cheating or anything, it's not my decision. So I basically passed the buck to the shift manager, and I was done with it. I washed my hands of it. And then next thing you know, they told me, go home. You're being investigated. You're going to be suspended without pay right now. And then the dealer got suspended, and the other floor got suspended. And then 2 weeks later, they fired me for doing my job, which was crazy. I could not believe it. And
I mean, it sounds like they must have heard a different version of the story or something. I mean, I don't – it's just – it doesn't make sense to me.
Unless that lady had a lot of juice and you embarrassed her.
Well – I had a friend who got fired many years ago from the Flamingo because they did something like that, and the lady was the mother of the right. shift manager or something like that. Yeah, they had enough juice where, and she was drunk and belligerent, and they got the guy fired.
See, and I had known, you know, because of my, you know, being customer service oriented, I had actually talked to this lady before in the past, and I knew that she had been a dealer before, which is even more weird. Like, there was something more to it. And,
maybe they were taking off the place and they didn't want you around to be able to say, hey, they're ripping the casino off.
Right. Yeah. It just didn't make sense to me. And, if they're listening, they better be careful these days because I'm going to be coming back to the Creighton now that I'm an AP.
Right. Well, that made you switch from the dark side to the good
side,
that right?
really pushed me over the top to, you know, damn near hate these people because, you know, I moved my entire life, you know, other than selling my house. And, you know, I moved my family down there and it cost me a lot of money to move down there. And then they just kind of backstabbed me and said, get out of here. We're done with you. And for no reason. Like, I, you know, I worked hard to learn and to, you know, there's not a lot of supervisors or pit bosses out there that, you know, even shift managers, even higher ups, casino operation, VPs, all this stuff, they don't really try to expand their mind and learn about new things within the casino business as far as, you know, beating games and protecting games and how to make more money. Somewhat like a Max Rubin kind of guy. Like, he was really pushing to learn things, and he wasn't afraid to listen to people too. You know, he had an open mind to, you know, that he knew he didn't know everything. So I put a lot of effort into it, and for them to really, you know, kick me to the curb like that, it was pretty disgusting on their part.
So how did you make the switch once you got fired? How did you make the switch into playing for a living?
It's a big difference between knowing how to count cards and knowing the casino business to being a successful AP.
Yeah, well, you know, talking with Max and then, you know, talking to a few other people, in order to be an AP, you know, inside the casino, if you want to catch an AP, you have to think like an AP. You know, so I really had to study being an AP before that. Fairly simple transition. There was some ups and downs with, you know, bankroll and all that stuff because it does take a lot of money to make money.
What was your first step? So you lose your job. You're stuck in Northern California.
So I actually sought out a backer to play blackjack because I knew that you needed quite a bit of money to really make a decent living at it. And I got a backer, and I was allowed $100,000 to play.
And good friend to have.
Yeah, he. I don't know how he trusted me, but he did, and proceeded to play around my hometown at pretty pretty high stakes, and that eventually got me pretty. I got my face. I got backed off at a lot of places in my hometown because the action I was giving them was, way above what they were normal, normal APs do in that town, basically. And the deal that I was in actually was pretty bad, because it was my first time and I didn't really know, how to treat it, as far as like pay. I got 10% of winnings only. I did have some good variance, so thankfully I did make a little bit of money, but, I found out later on that it really wasn't worth 10%. It was worth a lot more, especially with me burning out my face. It was quite unfortunate.
Because but now he handles all the losses.
He did handle all the losses. But I had a lot of good variance, so he never really had a loss. Never.
Well, the other thing is, there's a whole chapter in Exhibit CAA about how these kind of splits work, but if you're committed to play a certain number of hours or until there's a certain amount of win, then the amount of risk on the investor's side is much, much less than if it's, I'm going to go play for a weekend or something like that.
Right, right. And I found out very quickly that 10% is not a good deal.
Well, you can't make a living on that.
Correct.
You can't live on
that. Yeah, and like I said, I did have some good variance, so I did make a little bit of money. I took that money and then I went solo. We parted ways. And then I took a huge downswing, which was horrible. What great timing that is. You finally go on your own and then you hit a big downswing. It was roughly about $25,000 and then just basically went broke. And I couldn't play anywhere around town. So I had to travel and, the cost of travel was getting higher and higher for me. But the good games were right in my backyard. And that probably had a good reason why my downswing happened as well. So then I went back into the casino business for a little bit and tried to, get some more money and ended up contacting a few other people and getting in back into the AP world. And now I'm actually on a pretty good deal where everything is fair and, the the money is good and we have a significant bankroll that we're working with, and the other person is an AP as well, so he understands that 10% is not a good deal. and
you moved on from counting cards,
right? Yeah, and I've expanded tremendously into slot machines and into marketing and hole carding and all kinds of other angles. So the edges are significantly higher.
Now, since your partner in this endeavor is sitting quietly in the back of the room, if he left the room, would you say anything different?
No, I wouldn't say anything different, other than he has a nice car.
He does have a nice car. Yes, he does.
He was parked in my driveway. I had a party earlier this year, and my neighbor has a, 3-year-old or 4-year-old. And my neighbor came and said that he had come running in the house and said, Batman is next door. because he had seen his car and thought it was the Batmobile.
Right.
It isn't. Now, on that car, if you ever get a ride, and clearly you go cruising for babes, although you're a married man. So on that subject, how does your wife handle you being an AP? And
were you married when you went broke with this? And
yeah, she went through all the ups and downs with me, and
she let you get back into it.
Yeah, well, she understands how everything works. So it's a tough thing, and I've proven to her through especially when I learned how to do slots and the higher edge stuff that the money can come a lot easier than playing blackjack. So she was, a lot more confident with me making this transition from, full-time, steady paycheck to being an AP on the road, basically. And it just so happens that she actually works for a travel company, you know, an airline. So I get to travel at a, you know, very discounted price.
Oh, that's a nice perk to have.
Yeah.
It's a real nice perk.
For, you know, some of the listeners that are thinking about doing this stuff, you know, travel expenses add up very, very quickly. This is one of the things about my partner. He's very good at, you know, saving money on expenses and travel and stuff like that. So, which I'm not too savvy at. And maybe we can say, you know, he was on the show previously, so most people will know who he is. It's Vagabond. But, yeah, so, you know, that's another thing. Like, you know, having a good partner is probably, you know, very, very helpful. Like, and it kind of relates to this casino business. You have to keep an open mind when you're doing this stuff. Like, Vagabond brings so many different things as far as experience with, you know, traveling and coupon saving and things like that. And then as well as, like, his hole carding. I wasn't very, you know, good at hole carding, but he brings that to the table. And I have a lot of experience with, you know, pitch blackjack games where he has mostly played shoes. And
well, also just, you know, the road can be a very lonely place.
Right.
And so just having somebody else that you're traveling with, plus it's also safer. I mean, they're just no end of the benefits to me.
Yeah,
you know, and I mean, I've said many times on the show, if I had to play alone, I wouldn't play.
Yeah, we were recently at a casino, and we were doing a play there. Started out as a slot machine, and Vagabond was only playing the slot machine, and I ended up having to find some other source of EV, so I ended up going and playing some of the tables, and won a decent amount of money, and, you know, cash out issues, we try to avoid some, and we don't really want to have our picture taken. So I ended up going out, you know, a different entrance. I went through the valet, and I just ended up running through the bushes basically, and worried that people were going to be chasing me. And I saw a security car coming after me. And like in that moment, if you're by yourself, it's like pretty scary. You got a significant amount of chips and money on you. Like, you know, they could basically shake you down and take it from you almost, you know, and having
not almost they sometimes do, especially in Indian casino.
Yeah, and you know, having a partner, you know, Vagabond with me, I can, you know, call him, hey, get over here and, you know, get your camera out and film this or whatever, you know, and it's an added safety measure basically having somebody with you. And like you said, it's also good to have somebody with you just to, you know, kill time and talk, and on the road especially.
Yeah,
a recent guest we had was KC, who did the documentary on Inside the Edge. And he was going across the country solo, and he got so lonely that he went home and got his Weimaraners. Now, I'm guessing Vagabond
And then the last part of the trip, he got his dad to fly in and ride right, along with him.
I'm guessing Vagabond is a better companion than Weimaraners. I'm not sure.
Just a little bit. A little bit better. Yeah, just a little bit.
All right. So it's not a fluke. We thank you very, very much for sharing your insights with us. We wish you and Vagabond continued success.
I appreciate it, Bob. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.